Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Judith Stone, whose book is When She Was White, The True Story of a Family Divided by Race. Judith Stone is the author of one other book and co-author of another, is an editor at O Magazine, is
yes,
that correct?
Yes, a contributing editor.
Written for New York Magazine and the New York Times. Judith Stone, When She Was White, is the story of Sandra Lang, a woman in South Africa who was born to white parents but looked like a light-skinned black woman. Over the course of years in apartheid, her classification was changed from white to colored to white to colored, and eventually apartheid ended. How did you get involved with writing the book When She Was White?
In the year 2000, Sandra was reunited with her white mother after a 27-year estrangement. A filmmaker in London heard her speaking on BBC Radio, thought her story would make a wonderful dramatic film, a feature film, and he tracked Sandra down in the small black township where she was living. He secured the rights to her story and had been working on a screenplay with a South African screenwriter for about a year when a friend of his, who was at the time the head of Miramax Books, said he thought that Sandra's story would make a wonderful memoir. What he and the filmmaker thought was that they would find a collaborator to help Sandra tell her story as a first-person memoir. The head of Miramax Books called the editor-in-chief of O Magazine, and she was kind enough to recommend me as a collaborator, I think perhaps because I had edited a Holocaust memoir and had had the experience of revisiting difficult material.
So you dealt with Holocaust survivors. How did the Holocaust survivors' memories, how did those relate, say, to Sandra's memories and the victims of the Holocaust to the victims of apartheid?
One of the interesting things to me was this. Sandra sometimes tells the same story in a slightly different way. As a journalist, I thought, I must find the definitive version of this story. I must pin things down. But I learned from two sources that this wasn't necessarily the case. One of those sources was a book called Testimony by the psychiatrist Dory Laub and a co-author about the testimony of Holocaust survivors. And he writes about a particular case. It was a meeting of psychologists and historians at which Holocaust survivors gave testimony. One woman was talking about an uprising at, I believe, Auschwitz, an uprising of the prisoners. And she talked about how she'll never forget that day, the sight of the prisoners rising up and the smoke belching from the four chimneys of Auschwitz. After the woman spoke, one of the experts said, "We must discount this woman's testimony. There were not four chimneys at Auschwitz. There were only two." And Dory Laub spoke up and said, "What this woman was testifying to was a breakage in the framework of life. And the essence of her testimony is correct, whether the number of chimneys is correct or not." And I came to see that though Sandra might change a few details based on what she remembered at that moment, who was listening to her, how she felt at the time, the essence of her story remained the truth. I also encountered the work of a woman named Phumla Gobodo Madikizela. She wrote a wonderful book called A Human Being Died That Night. She's a psychology professor at the University of Cape Town, and she was a commissioner on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of 1996, the body that gave a public hearing to previously suppressed stories of human rights abuse in South Africa. And she says in her wonderful book, and I spoke with her as well, that every version of trauma that the victim gives is the true version. It represents what's going on within that person at the time. It's the essential emotional truth, and it represents the progress or regress that the victim is experiencing in dealing with that trauma.
Judith Stone, you got this assignment. At that point, you had not heard of Sandra Lang.
I had heard of her. In the year 2000, I read a story that appeared in the New York Times about her reunion with her mother. That was all I knew about her. And at the time, I remarked on what an unusual case it was and how fascinating. But beyond that, I knew nothing. So I had to throw myself into research.
This is long before you contacted Sandra.
not too long before, I was asked if I would be interested in writing the book in August, and Sandra and I met in November of 2001. In the intervening months, I read everything I could get my hands on and watched the two television documentaries that had been made about Sandra, one in 1977, made by Anthony Thomas for the BBC, and one in 1998 by the South African Broadcasting Company.
In America, Sandra Lang is not exactly a household name. However, she was in South Africa.
Yes. She made news from the time she was removed from school in 1966. Her parents had sent her to a very conservative white boarding school. The school had to take her because her birth certificate said she was white. But Sandra looked different from the other children. For 4 years, a group of parents and teachers worked behind the scenes to get Sandra kicked out of school. In 1966, the police came and took her away, deposited her with her parents, and said she's no longer white. The newspapers reported Sandra's plight, and Sandra isn't sure how the newspapers found out about her, but from looking over newspaper archives and looking at Sandra's recently released government file, we petitioned to look at her file through the new Access to Information Act. It seems clear that her father brought the case to the attention of the Afrikaner Press, and then it became well known both in South Africa and in Europe. And it was reported in the States as well.
So at that point, Sandra didn't even know how it had happened.
No.
So let's talk a little bit here about Sandra.
Yes.
Sandra's parents look white. There's nothing about them that would indicate black ancestry.
What her parents say is this. They swore before God and a magistrate that she was their biological daughter. And they said often in the press, it must have been something that happened far back in our family history. We know of no marriages between black and white people. That's a little ingenuous. A little disingenuous, because certainly had there been an interracial liaison, it was not likely to have been a marriage. It was likely to have been some sort of coerced relationship. If not overtly coerced, then one with a great power differential, usually involving a white man and woman of color who worked for him. However, geneticists say today that any living Afrikaner has at least 10% non-white genes. A member of the African National Congress said to me on one of my visits to South Africa, if DNA testing had existed during apartheid, no white family could have called itself white. Beginning in 1652, when the first permanent white settlement was founded near Cape Town, the white invaders and the indigenous population mixed and mingled genes, despite laws to the contrary, and it's perfectly possible, given the genetic and social history of South Africa, for a child like Sandra to appear in a white family. It doesn't happen often, but I think it happens more often than comes to the attention of the press. There was a case, actually, in the 1980s, similar to Sandra's, a child known to the press only as Basil E., in Cape Colony, was born to white parents, and the Department of Social Services convinced the parents to put the child up for adoption. He actually ended up living in a so-called colored orphanage, and his parents visited him regularly. That's the only other case I know of that garnered press attention, and it wasn't nearly as big a deal as Sandra's case was in her time.
You went there and suddenly discovered that this was emblematic of a bigger story, which is the story of South Africa itself.
Absolutely. Sandra, you know, it's not easy being a symbol. It's hard work being a symbol. But Sandra has, during her life, symbolized different things to different people. But her case is emblematic of the lunacy, cruelty, and arbitrariness of race classification. And really the whole idea of race, which is certainly socially meaningful, but not particularly biologically meaningful. Beverly Tatum, who's the president of Spelman University, says in her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? I'm paraphrasing now. Given what paleontologists and geneticists tell us about human origins, which is that the first modern humans emerged in southern Africa about 120,000 years ago, you can really only safely classify human beings into two categories, those who accept their African heritage and those who don't.
You went to South Africa and interviewed Sandra and spent time with her and her friends and, you know, did everything that a journalist does. You're a white woman from America. What did you see in terms of racism in South Africa today?
Well, there's certainly de facto segregation. Certainly there's a great wealth gap. But as the Nobel Prize-winning novelist Nadine Cordimer has said, you can't reverse 300 years of oppression in 5 years, in 10 years, or in 15 years. And as she said, on the 10th anniversary of the end of apartheid, which ended in 1994, of course, with the first free and democratic elections in South Africa ever, and the election of Nelson Mandela to the presidency, Nadine Cordimer said, the European nations have had a lot longer than we have to achieve equality, and they haven't quite managed it yet.
Well, you said before we went on the air that one thing that changed in you was your own perception of white privilege and your own white privilege.
Yes, I'm certainly aware of white privilege in an intellectual way here at home in the States. But in South Africa, it was so painfully obvious that I had unearned privilege even in post-apartheid South Africa, the new South Africa. So I came away being especially aware of that. An interesting thing is I sort of got a pass being an American. When I visited Sandra in the black township where she lived when I first met her, she translated for me. Her neighbors were saying, you know, what's this Boer, what's this Afrikaner doing here? And Sandra said, she told them, no, it's okay. She's from overseas. She doesn't know. Oh, okay, she's from overseas. So I was kind of in a special category of visitor.
Even during apartheid, American blacks were honorary whites.
Honorary whites, yes. And during apartheid, black Americans visiting South Africa could go places that black Africans couldn't.
Judith Stone, even though she looked, quote, colored, being the designation, her parents were white, her older brother looks white, her younger brother looks kind of like she does,
yes,
but sufficiently white-looking to get away with it.
Yes, by the time he went to the same school from which Sandra was expelled, he had a little bit of trouble getting in, but he had much smoother sailing. There was a bit of talk among parents about whether he should be allowed to attend the school, a little bit of teasing from the kids. They called him Brown Bread as a nickname for his whole school career, but there wasn't the uproar that Sandra caused.
So what happened was that Sandra, growing up in a small township, mostly knowing black people because there weren't that many whites around where she was.
Yes, she and her parents and her brothers lived in a very isolated, tiny community, and her parents kept a shop that served a nearby black township. Before she went to school, her only chums were black children.
So she had no idea. She goes to this school, and suddenly she's confronted with people calling her names. Her parents say, ignore them, which she takes to heart.
Yes. Her parents said, pay no attention, don't listen to what the children say. And in order to keep her parents as figures of authority whom she could trust and who could protect her, she internalized what her parents told her, even though what she saw in front of her eyes was different. And she sort of shut down, and she closed off her observational and analytical skills. It went from being, she was a very bright and observant child, but she had to not see what was in front of her, which is a kind of a, it's a human thing, but it's a very South African thing, not seeing what's in front of you so that you can maintain keep your conscience intact in the case of the white community and have the strength to struggle on in the case of the black community.
So she was removed from school because enough parents had complained, and, of course, the people at the school complained, and she was happy about it because she'd been treated so badly.
She was not sorry to leave. Her parents were mortified. Her parents took her case to the Supreme Court. And at the time Sandra was removed from school, the key criteria for determining race were appearance and acceptance. And that led to some odd cases, like the case of Mr. David Song, who in 1962, Mr. Song was a Chinese businessman living in South Africa. His race classification was colored, subcategory, other Asian. And he convinced 350 of his neighbors and colleagues to sign affidavits saying that they accepted him as white. The Race Classification Appeal Board had to abide by the law, and they changed his classification to white. At the same time that Chinese South Africans were classified as colored, other Asian. Japanese South Africans, because Japan was a valued trading partner of South Africa, were classified as honorary white.
She's reclassified as colored, which is halfway between black and white.
It's the designation at the time for a mixed-race person. There were seven very complicated sub-designations, but the easiest way to say it is mixed race.
But a Chinese person, a person from India, yes, would be mixed race, yes, would be considered colored as well.
In the 18th and 19th century, indentured servants were brought from India, essentially slaves.
At that point, she's declared colored, which,
yes,
means she could only be a servant of her parents.
Yeah, according to the letter of the law, the only way she could stay in the same house with her parents was as a servant. She was allowed to stay with her family while the case was under appeal. They lost the Supreme Court case, but just 2 months after that decision, Sandra was white again because the law had changed. In 1967, an amendment to the Population Registration Act was passed saying that appearance and acceptance were no longer the key criteria for determining race. There was one sole criterion, and that was descent. If your parents were white, you were white.
So suddenly she's white, but of course she still looks like she's not white, so she can't get into any school. They finally find a school for her. Everything is fine. She kind of drifts out of the headlines. At which point, she's 15 years old, and she meets a black man in his 20s, and she runs off with him.
Yes.
Now, the question at that point is, does she consider herself white at that point? Does she consider herself black? What are the motivations for running away?
You know, I think the motivations are many, and I think that they're not all conscious. This is what Sandra says. She was in love with Petrus. She knew her father wanted her to marry a white man, but she said, I just didn't feel comfortable with white men. My father wanted me to date them. I couldn't, she said. I couldn't. Not wouldn't or didn't want to. She says, I couldn't. She was beginning to forge a black identity, although it was still kind of unclear and amorphous to her. In the book Powers of the Weak by Elizabeth Janeway, she says the first power of the weak is to resist the definition of others and insist on self-definition.
So she ran away and she was accepted, but in point of fact, they all viewed her as white.
Yes, at least some of her black in-laws and stepchildren regarded her as white. Sandra's new black mother-in-law saw only a child she adored. Jenny, her mother-in-law, gave her perhaps the only unconditional love of her life so far. But others in the family told me later, one of her stepsons, for example, said that the family welcomed Sandra because it was prestigious to have a white woman in the family.
What's odd is that through all of this, you would think, here's a bright woman. Of course, she's putting on survival blinkers all over the place.
Exactly.
However, she never really seems to become politically active, yet she is a very visible symbol of all that's wrong in South Africa.
She wasn't political, and she has said to me directly, I don't think about political things. She may not have been a volunteer in the anti-apartheid movement, but she was a conscript.
Did anybody from the movement, from the ANC, ever approach her?
No. You know, she lived eventually in townships that were a hotbed of ANC anti-apartheid activism. But as she says to me, I paid no attention to politics. And, you know, there was a time when I was disappointed by this when I first met her. I thought, gee, here's a woman who's been through such difficulty and is such a symbol of the cruelty and lunacy and evil of apartheid. And she didn't become a leader or a teacher or a healer or an artist. Isn't that a shame? But I came to see that 99% of the people who are buffeted by historical forces don't become leaders or teachers or healers or artists. They're poor schlubs putting one foot in front of the other and trying to keep themselves and their families safe and thriving. I became more and more convinced that their stories needed to be told, and that if every story that emerged from the apartheid era was a story of triumph, it would really be a false account, because the damage lingers. To just talk about triumphs suggests that there's no work to be done, and there's work to be done.
All of this brings up the history of apartheid itself. the Afrikaners, the Dutch, settled in South Africa in the 17th century.
Right. The original settlers stayed in the area around Cape Town, and they displaced and decimated, more than decimated, the indigenous population of people they called Bushmen, the San tribes people who had lived in that area for thousands and thousands of years. When the British in the mid-19th century, early to mid-19th century, took over Cape Colony and made slavery illegal, a group of Afrikaners called the Voortrekkers pushed inland. The territory that they claimed was unpopulated, it was temporarily depopulated because of a Zulu war of expansion.
There was an uneasy peace between the Afrikaners, the Dutch, and the English, which burst into war in the Boer War, at which point English win, but they realize, hey, we're outnumbered, and suddenly they're pals again.
That's right. The victors and the vanquished join forces against the black majority, and the Union of South Africa is formed. The Afrikaners would only sign off on the deal if segregation became the official policy of the Union of South Africa, and this paved the way for the apartheid era, which began in 1948 when the National Party came to power, and they institutionalized the social and political system that had actually existed for the 300 years before.
A few years before that was World War II. Now, South Africa being a part of the British Empire at that particular time, of course, was on the side of Britain. However, the Afrikaners, their racial ideas seem more Nazi than anything else.
A group of Afrikaners who, in fact, went to school in Germany, went to university in Germany, had a great deal of admiration for the policies of the Nazi Party and a great deal of personal admiration for Adolf Hitler. Among them, Hendrik Verwoerd, later the Prime Minister of South Africa and the man who's called the architect of apartheid.
At its height, apartheid meant that there was very little intermingling between the races, except the blacks were workers and servants.
White supremacy was an explicit part of Afrikaner policy. The best way to maintain white supremacy was through segregation, and the best way to maintain segregation was to label everybody, classify everybody according to race, and see to it that they saw very little of each other by making them live separately. And a form of education for black people, Bantu education, instituted in 1954, was designed to be deliberately inferior and to create laborers and not politically active people.
And Sandra had not been born then, but even after she was born, the African government was doing all kinds of things. She had to resettle at one point because they decided to move a whole bunch of people from one place to another.
That's absolutely right. Between about 1966 and almost 1990, at least 3.5 million South Africans of color were subject to forced relocation. In Sandra's case, that meant that she and her husband, who lived in a poor but decently thriving rural area, were told by the government that they had 2 weeks to vacate their nice little brick house that they'd struggled to build. Bulldozers came and knocked down their house and the homes of their neighbors, and they were sent by truck to an outlying district in the back of beyond with no running water and no dwelling places and certainly no industry or jobs and very little arable land.
You know, we talked about the Nazis, but this really does sound like Israel's attitude toward the Palestinians.
I don't know that I'm qualified to comment on that. The apartheid plan is so crazy. It just sounds lunatic when I say it, but the basic plan of apartheid is so crazy, it doesn't sound real. But it was. The plan was to remove all black people from South Africa. And the apartheid government was well on its way to doing that in this way. 10 homelands were created based on historical tribal affiliation. Black South Africans were to be removed to these homelands, which were putatively independent nations, recognized by no one in the world but the nation of South Africa. Black people were to be removed to these independent homelands called Bantustans and stripped of their South African citizenship and allowed to return to South Africa as guest laborers. Thousands of South Africans were denationalized, black South Africans, and could enter the land of their birth only with a passport.
So Sandra married this man.
He had another wife. She didn't marry him under South African civil law, and she didn't marry him under tribal law either. She became his common law wife, and she became essentially the junior wife in a traditional Swazi family. That was the family's traditional tribal affiliation. Petrus's father also had two wives, and the two of them got along with each other very well. Sandra eventually, although at first she wasn't welcomed by the senior wife, eventually became close friends with her.
And eventually the relationship with Petrus, that man, fell apart. She meets someone else, and her life goes through the normal life of a person growing up, except, of course, she's still estranged from her white family, and she tries to get back in touch with them. She finds her brother, and he keeps her from their mother. Her father dies when she's out of touch. She tries to reconcile. She finally meets the mother. Did you get a chance to meet the mother before she died?
I did not. She died just a few months before I met Sandra. But that was a momentous occasion in Sandra's life because Sandra had internalized also a great deal of guilt. She felt that she needed to ask her mother's forgiveness for running away. It was interesting. She became obsessed with finding her mother, and she felt that her happiness depended on being forgiven by her mother. It was incredibly meaningful to her that she see her mother, feel loved by her mother. Although her mother had Alzheimer's, she recognized Sandra, and they were able to have some good contact before the mother disappeared into a fog. And Sandra says she felt forgiven. The unanticipated result of that reunion is that, first of all, Sandra felt freed from the burden of guilt and freed to see Jenny, her black mother-in-law, as her true soul's mother. She said, you know, Jenny was really more like a mother to me. Jenny was there when my children were born. Jenny taught me how to be a wife, and I think in some ways my white mother was a stranger to me in the end.
Putting aside color and privilege, because the Langs lived in the outback of South Africa. How different would it have been in terms of culture moving from a white household, an Afrikaner household, to a black household?
There were many differences. In one conversation, Sandra said to me, you know, when I was white, people did things for me, and when I was black, I did things for myself, but I liked doing things for myself. You know, the biggest difference was the lack of freedom of movement. Black people had to carry a pass, and their movement from place to place was severely curtailed. They got inferior education and health care and housing. They were subject to forced relocations, and whites weren't. In 1966, the year Sandra was removed from school, a white minor made 21 times the amount that a black minor earned, for example. The difference was huge.
But living within a household that's African rather than a household that's Dutch creates even more difference, I would guess.
You know, Sandra said an interesting thing. She said that her parents didn't have many friends. She saw a few relatives occasionally. When she moved in with Petrus's family, she was delighted with how peopled their lives were. Relatives and friends were constantly dropping by. She enjoyed the sense of community. She felt accepted. She felt calmer. She said, I felt stronger inside.
And that's when she began to heal.
Yes.
It took her a long time to begin to understand what has happened, and it sounds as if it wasn't really until you began spending time with her and an old roommate of hers from her days in school began spending time with her that she really began to understand.
I can't take any credit for enlightenment of any sort. I think the process of talking about what happened to her was really healthy and helpful for her. But Sandra began emerging from the dissociative state that was her chief defense as a child. Before I came on the scene, there were a couple of reasons. Chief among them was the reunion with her mother.
The book ends where she finally had been able, through selling her rights to her story, been able to buy a very nice house in a nice area, to make a living, she became a shopkeeper, a kind of illegal shopkeeper, but everybody was, and was quite successful at it with a few bumps along the way. I guess last summer she was forced to close the shop?
Yes, a little before that. What happened was, ironically, she was the victim of zoning laws, and considering that zoning was the bane of her existence, zoning along racial lines, it's somewhat ironic, but the municipality in which she lives, a mixed-race municipality, is building a huge shopping center, and so they cracked down on the informal economy businesses in her neighborhood, including the shop she kept in her garage, and she was really a gifted shopkeeper. It was, after all, the business of her parents. She had struggled to get the shop to work, and as you say, she had some false starts, but it was really blossoming. So she closed her shop, but the good thing that's happened since that time is that all of her children are happy, healthy, and employed, and really doing well. Her second husband, her common-law husband, Johannes Motlaung, is a truck driver. And so, knock on wood, everybody's doing well, and the family is there as a cushion. And she's thinking about what to do next. She's happy being a grandma, a very young grandma. She's 51.
Has she seen a manuscript of the book?
Yes, actually. We went over an earlier draft of the book, page by page, and she gave me her input. I don't know how she feels about this draft. She knows about almost everything that's in it because we've gone over it so many times. I know she's pleased that the book is coming out, and I know she's not particularly pleased to be in the public eye.
Is the book scheduled for publication in South Africa?
Not yet. Miramax Publishing is working on the foreign rights, even as we speak. So that will be an adventure when this book comes out in South Africa.
Not only for her, but for the White family, too, because her two brothers would suddenly be back in the spotlight.
Yes, and that will be difficult for them.
When you were done working on the book and you're back in the United States, you talk in a kind of vague sense about understanding white privilege better. I mean, it's pretty obvious over there. Over here, when you look at America then, does that change how you view things here, too?
Yes, I'm much more aware of white privilege here. And when I think about what happened to Sandra and I talk about it to people and they're deeply shocked, I like to move the conversation around to the fact that everything that happened to Sandra could happen here and has happened here. We've certainly had slavery. We've certainly had Jim Crow laws. We've had forced relocation. We've had race classification. The last race classification court case in the United States was in 1984, the Susie Phipps case in Louisiana. So-called anti-miscegenation laws have been on the book, were on the books until the 60s and later, actually, in some states. And racial issues are in the forefront of American life and need to be dealt with. And I returned from South Africa with a stronger sense of having had privilege handed to me without having earned it.
Judith Stone, now you've finished this book. Are you working on another book?
I'm going to take a long nap and think about what to do next.
And you're still working at O?
I'm a contributing editor at O, yes.
And which means what?
Well, it means that I write stories for the magazine, and sometimes I work in the office.
Ever think about writing fiction?
I am beginning to think about writing fiction. In December and January, I spent 6 weeks at the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire working on fiction in secret. Now my secret's out. We'll see.
You've been listening to an interview with Judith Stone, whose book is When She Was White, The True Story of a Family Divided by Race. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.